Okay, I'm talking today about the chapter entitled The Power Responds to All Alike. And we're going to talk about one of my favorite elements of religious science, which is living fearlessly, or living boldly, as Oprah might say. We need to live our philosophy, not just talk about it. And our philosophy has no meaning if we don't start putting it to use and incorporating it in our life. We can talk all we want. We can make all kinds of claims, such as there's no sickness. But until we move through it, we're like a bunch of chattering parrots. So if there's no sickness, then if there is sickness at all, there's also wellness, and we can claim it today. And so we've really proven over and over again that by thinking correctly and making a conscious use of the law of attraction, we can create some definite things, such as wellness and healing from any kind of illness. We have to remember that the law is out there. It's working for all of us all the time. It doesn't matter if, you know, you have white hair or brown hair, or if you're a midget or a horse, it always works. And to master it, we really need to be careful of what we're thinking, because we're always creating. And why would I even say such a thing? It's because our thoughts are always creative. So I was telling Stephen in the car on the way down here, if we're sitting there worrying about something, we're creating. And remember, the law is always flowing through us. So, like I said, worrying creates, as does appreciation. I want to take an extreme example. And let's say I've got this attitude that the law of attraction doesn't work. It's a bunch of made-up baloney. And actually, the truth is that the law is always at work, or law of attraction, that's what I'm referring to. But it works in accordance with our underlying beliefs. So if I believe, for instance, I grew up believing I was poor. This is not true of me, but if I grew up believing that I was poor, I can manifest this with no problems at all, I'm sure. But thank God I didn't. And why would anybody want to go through life believing that they're poor and then manifesting it? That's not a lot of fun. So I think that controlling our thought processes is extremely important, because we really don't want to be poor. We want to maintain an affirmative frame of mind and also an appreciative frame of mind. And we need to be able to look at a discordant fact in its face and deny that it has reality for us. And we know we can change it, these facts. We can change our consciousness. And I have a great example. As you know, I've been in the process of moving on top of my broken leg. So I put my house in the market last Wednesday. Yes, it was last Wednesday at 9 a.m. There was an open house on Sunday. It was Wednesday week. Uh-huh. Open house on Sunday. Tuesday night, I was signing the contract for the house.
Wow.
Oh, my.
Yay. You great. Are amazing.
Thank you. Thank you. I've been working on this one for a while, though.
Yeah.
And then the inspection was yesterday, Friday at 1 o'clock. We had to get the inspection done within 4 days. And that was the only thing that was going to keep this sale from going through. So Friday morning, I get this email from my former neighbor saying, "Your house alarm is going off." I'm like, whatever. Hmm. And I started getting into a really foul mood because I was working at the time. So I left, you know. Fortunately, my boss wrote me that very instant and said, "Hey, your timesheet's messed up. Go correct it." So I did, and added some time for me to go back to my old house and fix the alarm. So I had totally forgotten my alarm was still on. So I called ADT right away and had that sucker turned off in terms of my account. Then I went over to the house and I followed their instructions for doing a controlled shutdown on the alarm system. So I got that done. And in addition, you know, on the way over, I deliberately spent time enjoying the flowers on the way over, the way that they've got some lovely plantings along the intercounty connector. I was in such appreciation, and I was thinking, oh, this is great. I even stopped at Dunkin' Donuts for my favorite cup of tea, and got to my old house, and indeed, the alarm was going off. And I thought to myself, if I was here for a house inspection, I'd probably flunk it right now. And so I thought, oh, I'm so grateful that all of this has happened. So I got the alarm turned off, and I got to eat my breakfast sitting out in my old patio, enjoying my former garden because it's in full bloom right now. And I saw these wonderful fruit bushes that I've planted, and it was doing well. So I felt like the whole thing went really well. Then, yesterday afternoon, I haven't heard anything about the inspection yet, and so I get, late in the afternoon, I get an email from my realtor with a long list of questions that needed to be answered that very day. So I told her I couldn't answer them right away because I had Stephen with me, and we were busily unpacking and about to go eat. So it gave me time to cool down. And again, I just spent time not thinking about it. And when I got back home afterwards, I was able to answer all the questions really factually. And there were some that could have generated a little fear, like there's some cracks near the foundation. Do you know anything about that? And I was able to answer honestly, if there were, I've never noticed them. They were there before I bought the house. Because I certainly had plenty of people going through my house doing repairs over the years. They would have said something. So by the end of that, I was feeling pretty good. And I'd answered all the questions honestly. And I gave them a long list of all the manuals I was going to give them. I had left them a lawnmower and a snow thrower, and a lot of my gardening tools. And I felt like I'd done the best I could to make these people feel welcome, because I knew that whoever was going to buy that house from me was going to love it and fit in with the neighborhood perfectly. So I got word right before I came here today that they want to go ahead with the purchase of the house. So awesome. It's going, yep, we will,
yes.
Right. So they will settle on the 25th of April, and I'll be free. Yes.
Wow.
So there's a wonderful, I could read the whole thing, but there's a wonderful story that Holmes tells in this chapter about this person that feels impoverished. And I won't read the whole thing, but remember, as I was going through this, I was deliberate and trying to shift my mind from worry and panic, actually. Because I'd been declaring that thing was going to be sold and we were going to move on. So Holmes says about this person who's impoverished, she says, right here, he must stop and declare these images of limitation are neither person, place, nor thing, and they have no power, personality, nor presence, and no real law to support them. He does not believe in them, and they cannot operate through him. He is free from their influence forever. He then begins to fill his thought with the idea of faith, the expectancy of good, and the realization of plenty. He senses and mentally sees right action in his life. He puts his whole trust in the law of good, and it becomes very real to him as he definitely speaks it into being, into his being, and into the being of his affairs. He denies anything and everything that contradicts his realization of this truth. And at this point of the realization, he meets a friend who immediately begins a tale of woe about hard times, bad business connections, in conditions, etc. And he listens to this tale of the serpent. He might reverse his previous affirmations and make negative his former mental and spiritual concept. But this doesn't mean he should refuse to hold conversation with people for fear they will neutralize the position which he's taken in his mind. but he should refuse mentally to accept the false position. Then he can talk with anyone and not be disturbed. And I don't know if there's ever been somebody that you have run into when you have this really strong belief, like I believed I was going to sell my house incredibly easily, mm-hmm. and that the people that bought it would totally love it. Well, I didn't talk to a lot of people about this unless I knew they were going to support me, because I had enough other things going on. I didn't want to have to spend a lot of time denying all that and saying, no, my truth is. And so I can totally, and I'm sure each of you have some point in your life when you can say you had a very strong belief that something positive was going to happen, and no matter what another person said, like, oh, no, it never works that way, that it actually does. It really does. And that's the point of the faith that we have here, which is that it works. Don't just be a parrot, but live it. Right? Right? So, it wouldn't be a complete talk if I didn't mention one of my favorite musicians. No, besides John. And his name was Franz Josef Haydn.
Really?
He was born on March 31st in 1732, and the reason I'm mentioning him is because his birthday was yesterday, and today, yeah, it's April Fool's, but his father was a real wheelwright, and he was also the equivalent of the local mayor, so these were not highly educated people, his parents, and neither parent could read music, but they both loved to perform folk music. They would have been at home at the local folk club or something like that. And they noticed that their son, because there was music going on in the house all the time, he appeared to be musically gifted, as well as his brother, Michael. So what they did was they sent the two boys to a place called Hainburg on the Donau. Donau is Danube in English, to train as a musician. He never lived with his parents again. He moved when he was 12.
Wow.
And he mostly sang at the choir at the time, and he didn't get a lot of formal music training. So then, oh, this is bad. The choir master at St. Stephen's Cathedral, where Haydn was performing, suggested that Haydn undergo a certain operation to prevent his voice from breaking. Oh, yes. But fortunately, his father stepped in, and he prevented that from happening. Thank God. So because of this prank that, and Haydn was a great prankster, that he had committed on another choir boy, Haydn was thrown out in the streets to fend for himself. And he wasn't real old at the time. So that was, being homeless when you're 12 or 13 is a difficult thing to have happen. But it turned out just right for him, because he ended up as a valet for an Italian composer who taught him the elements of music theory and composition, which you need to do the type of work that Haydn was destined to do. So he became one of the father of the string quartet and the symphony, and also a mentor to both Beethoven and to Mozart. Yeah, so he was like one of the most influential composers and musicians of his time, and think about how much change that brought about. If he had stayed in the choir and became a castrato, it'd be a very different life. So, I have a little quiz. How many symphonies did he write?
Oh goodness! Don't look at me for that. I don't know.
Anybody know? Want to guess?
Six.
Add 100 to that.
My goodness.
100, yes.
Wow.
And
symphonies?
Symphonies.
Wow. I know.
That's a lot of instruments, folks.
Right.
Yeah. The 19th century orchestra is about 100 people.
Wow.
Right. So that's a lot of what we call orchestration, because he had to write all the parts out on a score and that sort of thing.
It's not like a little song either. They're long pieces of...
Oh, exactly. Yes.
Mm. Yeah.
And he also wrote 68 string quartets, in other pieces like operas, trios, and he spent most of his time working in a court in Esterházy in Hungary. Mm. So this is, you know, it worked for him. He knew he had a talent. I was so inspired reading up on Haydn that I went out, I'm buying a book on Haydn and his life and his personality.
Nice.
Yeah, so he's an amazing guy when you think about what he has contributed to the world of music today. Mm-hmm. So in summary, the answer to every problem in the world can be found in the mind of God, which is flowing through us all the time. My mind is God's mind, right? And God knows and what to do, and God never makes mistakes. Therefore, we never make mistakes. Even things like breaking a leg are not a mistake. Maybe they're not pleasant, but there are things that come through that are our blessing. So that God in me not only knows what to do, but is also always leading me and inspiring me. So we increase our awareness of this flow through meditation, right? And prayer. And knowing this, we can move through ordinary activities in life with confidence, with boldness, with being fearless. And we know we're guided all the time. And just be willing to listen and constantly affirm that all is well. So I'm going to close with a quote from the end of the chapter. These are gorgeous quotes from Holmes himself. I cleanse the windows of my mind that it might become a mirror reflecting inspiration from the Most High. I do this not with strenuous effort, but through quiet contemplation, through gently reaching and affirming an inward recognition. Today I walk in the path of inspiration. I know exactly what to do in every situation. There is an inspiration within me which governs every thought, every action, with certainty, with conviction, and in peace. And so it is.
And so it is.
Did you hear every word?
Every word.
There you go.
And I wrote some down. Ones that were particularly good.
Were they clean?